of Nebraska is now open for the transaction of business. From Nye, all you have a business with this honorable court, and he shall be heard. God save the state of Nebraska and this honorable court.
Thank you. You may be seated. I appreciate everybody being here this morning, and good morning to you. I believe the best protocol is to keep your mask on when you are not presenting, but obviously we want you to take your mask off when you are so that everybody can hear. And likewise, we tend to take our masks off when we are asking questions. As you can see, we already introduced ourselves to WebEx arguments that we had earlier today, and I won't go through and introduce everybody, but as you can see, Justice Moore Lumen is participating by WebEx. With that in mind, the first case in person in the courtroom today is State versus John W. Dalton Jr. Mr. Hugg, good morning to you, and you may approach and you may proceed.
Good morning, Judge Miller, Lerman here. Thank you.
Good morning. May it please the court. My name is Jerry Hugg, attorney from Omaha, Nebraska. Appointed by the District Court of Douglas County to represent Mr. Dalton on his pro se motion for post-conviction relief. I'd like to start out by saying this is not my proudest moment before this court. I realized way too late, as of yesterday evening, that the brief that I filed with the court was a draft and not my final version, so I apologize for the lack of detailed legal argument presented to the court in the written brief. I apologize to my client specifically as well. But in that regard, I will address the two issues that were filed with this court in regard to his claims on post-conviction relief. As the court's aware, Mr. Dalton filed his pro se motion. The main claim was whether or not his district court counsel was ineffective for failing to file a notice of appeal. The court granted an evidentiary hearing on that matter. Deposition was taken of Mr. Dalton, and a deposition was taken of his trial counsel, or his district court counsel, and those were submitted to the court as part of the evidentiary hearing. The court then determined, after reviewing those depositions, that found in the district court order that the court believe the counsel adequately consulted with the defendant regarding his right to appeal, and found that the defendant did not expressly instruct counsel to file a notice of appeal. That was based in part on the deposition testimony of both Mr. Dalton and his counsel, district court counsel, in regard to what had transpired regarding the notice of appeal. Mr. Dalton claimed that he had sent a written request after receiving a letter from his district court counsel about his right to an appeal, and handed that to an employee at the jail because he was in lockdown at the time and unable to leave his cell. He doesn't remember specifically what day or what time, but he believed it was the day before he was taken to D&E, which I think the parties agreed would have been December 12th. 2018. His attorney at the district court level said that she never received that letter, that she had in fact sent him a letter regarding his notice of appeal and letting him know that there were deadlines that had to be met in that regard if he wished to file an appeal. So really, the Wagner and the Roe versus Flores Ortega analysis is a multi-part analysis, and I believe the district court in making a determination that trial court counsel had adequately consulted with the defendant, had to have made a couple of determinations under the case law that controls. The term consulted with or consulting with a defendant regarding the right to appeal is broken down into two parts. That is whether counsel advised the defendant about the advantages and disadvantages of taking an appeal and whether counsel made a reasonable effort to discover the defendant's wishes. I'm submitting to the court that based upon the evidence and the finding of the district court, that first part, whether the counsel advised the defendant about the advantages and disadvantages of taking an appeal, are addressed in the deposition and the court's findings. And is because that's a factual determination, the court would have to find clear error in that regard. But the question really before the court is whether or not his district court counsel made a reasonable effort to discover the defendant's wishes. In this case, as I previously stated, she sent a letter to Mr. Dalton advising him of his appeal rights and the deadline by which to respond to her.
Was that a standardized letter?
I believe it is out of the County Public Defender's Office. Yes, out of Douglas County Public Defender's Office. That's my understanding. It could be that each attorney in that office has a different version, but that we don't think we discussed that in the deposition.
How much of this is a credibility determination, and what effect does that have on our standard of review?
Sure. So because the district court, of course, was the trier of fact, and she determined that the trial counsel was credible in her statement in regard to what had transpired, then I think that's a clear error review on this court's part.
And you're not advocating that there was clear error in the past?
Not in that regard, no. I don't have anything to dispute the fact that trial counsel never received a letter from Mr. Dalton.
Would you agree it's fair to say currently our standard is that the burden is on the appellant or defendant to make a request for an appeal after being advised of the information?
I think that's part of it. I think that there is part of that, and I think that's the part that confuses at least me for the most part, is because we have this standard in both Wagner and Roe that I read to be, well, if the consultation takes place, which is the two-part test, then that's kind of where you end the analysis, right? I mean, Roe starts with, do you have a duty to consult to begin with? And that's a whole other string of markers that you have to hit as a defendant, right? So I think the standard is not if the defendant didn't, not whether the defendant actually told their trial counsel to file an appeal. That's part of the analysis, but I think the standard is that whether counsel made a reasonable effort in that regard to determine whether or not the client wants to appeal.
Would you suggest a new standard that unless they receive notice from the defendant not to file the appeal, they should?
No, there's no bright line rule. Right, Roe is very clear on that, and I think the Nebraska case law is very clear on that. There's no bright line rule because the bright line rules don't really play into the circular analysis. So
what is it about this one then?
I think what it is about this one is we've got an experienced public defender who in her deposition testimony says, look, I've had case managers call me from D&E or from the prison saying their clients want to file an appeal. I know there are communication issues. I've set some of those quotes out in the brief. And I know that sometimes people get moved right away from Douglas County down to D&E for their placement. And she understands that happens. So the question then becomes, is it reasonable for her to assume, one, that Mr. Dalton received the letter, if she knows that he could be moved very quickly? And two, is it reasonable for her to assume that no response means that he's not wanting to approach an appeal or pursue an appeal?
Did Mr. Dalton testify about whether or not he received the letter?
Yes, he did receive the letter.
So there's no doubt that he was advised.
No, there is no doubt that he was advised, but I think the reasonableness inquiry goes to counsel's conduct. She didn't know either way, one, whether he had received the letter. She assumed because it didn't come back to her in the mail. That's part of her deposition testimony, which is a reasonable assumption.
What do you think would have been a a reasonable effort in this case.
I think if given this council's understanding of the complexity of post-sentencing movement and screening of prisoners and things like that, it would have been reasonable for her to attempt to contact Mr. Dalton after not hearing back to confirm or deny his wishes to file an appeal so that she would have known.
How does that differ from the Bright Line?
Because she's not filing a notice of appeal. I think the Bright Line rule goes to the cases where the appellate courts, the federal appellate courts, have even said that, I think it might have been California, in Roe had said that you just have to file it as a matter of fact, unless your client has told you specifically not to do so. So I think that's the bright line rule part of it. But I think here the reasonableness analysis, like the court says, is based upon the unique facts and circumstances of each case.
You may have addressed this already, but you're not disputing that counsel consulted with your client, is that correct?
No, I think what I'm just, yes, I am in part doing that because the way that the term consulted with or consulted is defined by this U.S. Supreme Court is the two-part test. And that's whether or not counsel both advised the defendant about the advantages and disadvantages of taking an appeal and whether counsel made a reasonable effort to discover the defendant's wishes. That's what those two parts make up consulting, according to Roe versus Forrest.
Was there a deficiency in the letter that counsel sent to Mr. Dalton?
No.
So the consultation element was satisfied by the content of the letter?
I would say the advisement of the advantages and disadvantages was met. I don't believe that
so it's
the second part of consult got met.
And that would have required an additional inquiry by counsel. Is that what you're suggesting?
Yes.
Which she doesn't hear back. You know, she sent the letter. She knows she explained everything. But doesn't hear back, she should take a second step of an additional inquiry of some type.
I would say so because she admitted that she did discuss with Mr. Dalton that he could appeal his sentence if he was given consecutive sentences. And he was. So I think it would have been reasonable for an attorney in her position to double check because she had no response either way, yes or no.
Does the seriousness of the crime and the seriousness of the sentence have any impact on that consideration?
From a reasonableness, whether the attorney acted reasonably? I think it does. I would say it would to me. I would hope that it would just be reasonable to confirm or deny either way in every case, but I think given the seriousness of the offense, along with the fact that she had told him that he could appeal the consecutive sentence issues.
Does the number of years of or the breadth of experience of the defense attorney, which you have made reference to several times here today, is that part of the inquiry?
I know that there's a general requirement under Strickland that we look at a reasonable attorney as a general outline of what an attorney as part of normal competent practice would do, or not even in a non-deficient manner. But I think when the U.S. Supreme Court says we've got to look at the unique facts and circumstances of the case, that could include that attorney's experience.
Changing to the excessive sentence claim, hypothetically speaking, if this court were not to grant a new direct appeal, is excessive sentence claim procedurally barred?
No, and we all missed that down in the district court, and I believe Ms. Tangeman, the state has drawn out Dieterman to say that the proper procedure is just to present the appeal issue first, don't address any other issues that were raised, voluntariness of plea or excessive sentence or whatever it may be until the mandate from the appeal issues.
Is an excessive sentence required to be raised on direct appeal, though?
I believe it is, unless the appellate counsel is ineffective.
Assuming that we disagree with you about the direct appeal request issue. Is the any error of the district court in going on to consider the other issues that under Dieterman should not have yet been considered, is that harmless error?
I don't read Dieterman to state that the court would handle it as harmless error. I believe the passage from Dieterman says this is how it should proceed, and if that procedure is not followed, it will be sent back to the district court.
So we would send it back for the district court to turn around and say, I meant what I said, and I said what I meant, and here we come again?
That's likely what will happen, yes. Yeah. I see I'm out of time. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Ms. Tangeman, good morning to you.
Good morning, Your Honor. May it please the court, I'm Erin Tangeman, Assistant Attorney General representing the state of Nebraska. I will begin with the first assignment of error. Dalton alleged in his post-conviction motion that trial counsel was ineffective for failing to file a direct appeal when he instructed her to do so. This was the claim presented to the district court, and the district court did not find Dalton's assertions credible. Based on the testimony presented, Dalton cannot establish that the court's findings were clearly erroneous. Trial counsel testified that she explained the appeal options to Dalton in person prior to his sentencing and plea hearing, and that she also sent him a letter immediately following the hearing that advised him not only of his right to appeal, but specifically the deadline to do so and the deadline that she requested he notify her by. Dalton never told counsel in person, on the phone, or by mail that he wanted to appeal. Counsel further testified that she advised Dalton that she did not believe an appeal would be successful, but that she would have filed one if Dalton had instructed her to do so.
Have we in our case law said upon whom the risk of loss of a communication by a defendant to counsel requesting a direct appeal, on whom that risk of loss runs to?
I mean, if you have, I'm not aware of it right off the top of my head, but I think in this case, when you look at it factually, the district court did not find credible his claim that he sent a letter. He said the reason he requested it in a letter is because he was on lockdown and he was unable to call her by the phone call. He was unable to call her. And this is simply not credible because trial counsel testified to a voicemail she had from the defendant during that exact time frame when he said he could not call anybody. He called her to complain about the prosecutor making statements to the media. He could have told her during that phone call that he wanted to appeal, but he did not do so. So despite, you know, what the case law is on that, it comes down to a credibility issue here that the district court found he didn't even send a letter. That's not believable in this case. Counsel testified their means of communication, he called her. He called her a lot. He was very involved in his case and left voicemail messages to her over the course of her representation.
So that probably takes us back to your opponent's argument about the sufficiency of the consultation.
Yes, and my first thought on that is I don't know that the district court addressed that specifically because that was not specifically alleged in the motion. The motion was I told her to do this and she didn't do so. So there may not be a specific finding in the district court on that. And then I would also say that the U.S. Supreme Court has sufficiently addressed this issue in Roe versus Flores Ortega and has rejected a lot of the claims that opposing counsel is now making. It's, you know, if counsel is told, I want you to file an appeal, you're going to be deficient if you don't do so. If defendant says, I don't want you to file an appeal, then you can't be deficient. And then Roe v. Flores Ortega goes through, well, what happens when we don't have a straight yes or a straight no? We look at, was there a consultation? And if so, counsel can only be deficient if they fail to follow an express instruction from the defendant. And here we know that there was a consultation both prior to his plea hearing and in writing after the plea hearing. And I think it makes sense when you look at the facts of this case that he would not want to appeal. He pled guilty to 7 felony charges including three separate counts of first-degree murder, and he waived his pre-sentence investigation because he wanted to go immediately to sentencing. He was the one that started the plea negotiations in this case, and as counsel testified, he just wanted to get it all over with. Dalton wanted to take responsibilities for his offenses, and he wanted to begin serving his sentences at the time of the plea. His appellate issues were limited based on those pleas, as well as the type of crimes he committed, mandatory life for the three first-degree murders, and the use convictions would have to be consecutive. So it's completely understandable, given his mindset at the time that he pled, why he did not want to appeal in this case. I will move on to the Dieterman issue unless this court has any more questions regarding the first assignment of error. In State v. Dieterman, in this type of situation, this court was clear that the district court is to rule on the additional post-conviction claims only after the time to appeal this type of claim has expired or once the appeal is concluded. So if this court strictly follows Dieterman, that portion of the order should be vacated. One thing that gave me pause was the facts of this case are slightly different than Dieterman. In Dieterman, the order in question involved the granting of an evidentiary hearing on one claim and the denial of an evidentiary hearing on another claim. Here, the district court proceeded correctly by only granting an evidentiary hearing and not touching the other claims. And so it was only in that final order disposing of the direct appeal issue that the court also disposed of the other claims. So the facts are not identical to Dieterman, but the state would agree that Dieterman is the correct process and district court should not do what the district court did here until the appeal has been resolved.
You heard my question to opposing counsel. What's your answer? We send it back to make the trial judge say exactly the same thing all over again?
Well, I'm not sure. I've gone back and forth with it, and I think that is why I chose in my brief to say the court could do this or this, because it's a de novo review, giving in this case that the court got rid of the other charges because of the allegations. It has nothing to do with the record or anything that would require, because we don't have the plea hearing, we don't have the sentencing hearing, the court obviously can't review that. But the district court was correct in finding that there were no allegations of prejudice and only conclusions regarding deficient performance. So I'm not certain. I do think Dieterman needs to be followed by the district courts, and the court's language was strong in that opinion regarding if this happens in the future, we will vacate it. But I do recognize that it's a little bit different factual situation here. So we will leave it to the court.
Judge Miller-Lerman here, thank you. Are there implications for potential subsequent federal actions related to whether or not the remaining claims had been addressed by a trial court? In other words, if we get past the appeal or not appeal, and then we go on to some other allegations, how would the federal courts treat all of that as having been addressed by the state? Thank you.
Well, I think if for purposes of federal habeas corpus, it would basically be what this court decided. It would be a state procedural issue that the federal court would have to give deference, whether this court chooses to vacate that portion of the order and go back on the procedural setting that's already set forth in Dieterman, or whether this court decides we don't need to do that, we can take care of it here. I don't think that has any implications on the federal habeas situation, because the court has to give the state deference when it comes to state procedural rules, which that's what it would be in this case. Unless this court has any further questions for me, we would ask that the judgment be affirmed and give discretion on the portion of the order to this court on the Dieterman type issues.
Thank you very much. Do we have any time for rebuttal?
No,
there is no time for rebuttal. So we will go on to the next case of the day, which is Yorey versus Helms. Now we take a little break to cleanse and get everybody in and out, and you're using the right exit door, so I appreciate that. And again, thank you very much.